Welcome back, everyone, to Progressively Incorrect. My name is Zach Rochelle, and I am your host. A few quick things from our sponsors before we go over to Barbara Oakley. I'm sure you want to hear from her more than you want to hear from me. As you know, this podcast is sponsored by John Catt Educational. They publish some of the best books in education, including my book, Just Tell Them, The Power of Explanations and Explicit Teaching. If you are a teacher looking to have someone publish your book, I really recommend talking to the folks at John Catt. They make the process very, very easy for first-time publishers and for folks that are looking to spread their wings and spread their talents and insights through writing. Go talk to John Catt. I will put in the show notes some links to their catalog, and you can see all of their amazing evidence-informed books. And the second thing is, as you know, I'm the director at StepLab North America, and we do instructional coaching. If you're interested in instructional coaching training, a platform, a technology for how to centralize your instructional coaching, we offer up the tools and the training to be better at coaching, especially in the realm of the science of learning and explicit instruction. So come over and talk to me about that. Email me, shoot me an email. We'll get you started. Let's go on over to our guest right now, which I've been waiting for this moment for a long time. It's been several months of just seeing this in my calendar. I'm just so excited to talk to Barbara Oakley today. Barbara, how are you doing?
I am actually doing terrific, especially since I'm finally here on your show.
I'm so happy. I've been reading your books for some time. Very oddly, I actually cited one of your papers you were in for my dissertation around MOOCs, around learner control, which is like, I was like, oh, look at this. And I've seen you on so many different things, including recently an event that we're both sort of alumnus for, which is Research Ed Chile. Tell me, what have you been up to in recent days?
Let's see. I am just back from a trip to Mexico City, Santiago, Tokyo, Singapore, Armenia, Ha'il, Saudi Arabia, Dubai, and finally in Boston. So it's another round the world trip. And the great thing about that kind of thing, I'm coveting your Ho Chi Minh City mug right there. But the nice thing about doing this kind of thing is that you really get an overview of what is going on internationally in education, especially if you're speaking to all sorts of different groups, from academia to industry to monasteries to you name it. And oftentimes we don't realize it, but people tend to be, especially if you're an academic, you're like, you're in your niche and you do your research in that niche. And even if you're one of the world's greatest researchers, it becomes even harder for you to be cognizant of what the worldwide trends and perspectives are. So I try to keep my feet in both camps, sort of the what is going on in deep neuroscience and AI research, but also what are the implications in how everything's playing out internationally. And it's a little hard to do, but boy, is it fruitful what you discover.
And it's strange because I think most people think like teaching is teaching, schools are schools. But even within a small district that I work in, you realize that folks aren't talking to each other. There's no coordination. It's sort of a random assortment of different people and systems and ideas. And for my brain, that really, that really hurts. Really, really, it's difficult to wrap your head around when things aren't organized in a way that I think most people would hope. What are some of the lessons you're learning from having gone to all these places internationally that might maybe be important for us here in the United States to know about?
That the United States is not alone in having real problems with, for example, finding teachers who are comfortable with teaching math, in helping students to actually become successful with math. What I commonly find is that well-meaning constructivist approaches. That is the idea that, student-centered learning, students construct their own knowledge, that those have really spread widely around the world, and they sound so good. And the upshot is so pernicious. Many countries that have adopted these student-centered, more or less constructivist type approaches have over the last 30 years gone from, the top of the industrialized world to the bottom of the industrialized world. For example, New Zealand, which is sort of ground zero for constructivist approaches. It's a country that's filled with the nicest people and great teachers, and they kind of grab onto something that sounds helpful and good, and they don't look too closely, and they're not encouraged to look too closely at what the real upshot of these kinds of approaches are. And the upshot is now they're finding it difficult to even find teachers who can teach at elementary school levels because they simply don't have any kind of fluency or comfort with numbers. It's kind of like this thing where, for someone who is brought up in a constructivist approach, it's the idea that you get the general gist of, say, multiplication, but you don't necessarily have to rote memorize the multiplication tables because you can always look it up. But what results from this kind of thing is that you'll have, say, a nursing student who types 10 times 10 into a calculator, gets 1,000 out because they've mistyped a number, and they say, "Looks good to me," and they prescribe a medication that's 10 times bigger than it should have been. And this is actually starting to become a problem in many places around the world.
It's weird because it's generally, I think, accepted that taking a explicit approach, having systematic instruction that really makes sure you master certain foundational skills first before you proceed to like combining those skills into more complex skills. It's really accepted that in reading in early reading especially, that that's important. Increasingly that's accepted, and it's certainly accepted in like things like sports and learning music. But in you keep mentioning math, and you wrote an excellent article, which I will put in the show notes, and you call math education, you describe it as being in crisis. What makes that word appropriate? How do we know that that's the case as well? But I do want
Yes.
to, before we even go to that, I just think people are sold this idea that these constructivist approaches are new. Like they can't, like that's they're somehow like the name of this podcast, that they're future oriented, they're progressive, and there's sort of there's this romance, this romanticism involved with these, that these are always looking forward to a new world where things are different and innovation is, we can't teach to the old way. But you're saying that they're old.
Oh, it so makes me laugh. So, for example, not long ago, I was sitting in this was a different conference than the most recent one in Saudi Arabia. But in Saudi Arabia, they are able to bring some of the world's leading experts in for example, their creativity conferences. And so these people will get up there, and it's amazing to watch because, you've got watching the Zoom camera going panning over the audience, and it looks like a multi-million dollar production because it really is, that they've got all these top experts. And I look at their slides and I'm like, those are the same slides I saw 30 years ago about, how we're going to cooperative education is the new thing, and we're all working together actively to help. And I'm like, the only word is, like, on one slide, I will see the word AI. And otherwise, it's everything that I saw 30 years ago. And I'm just, it's amazing. We need a better word than post-constructivism, because that still centers on the idea of constructivism. But the reality is, Eastern approaches, however you might define them, where there's value placed on at least some degree of rote learning, along with some Western approaches, but done intelligently. So it's not just, oh yeah, kids construct their own learning. I mean, they construct their own learning when you scaffold it very carefully. And then, of course, they always say, well, we always said that we were going to scaffold it. But that's not true at all. That's not how it's implemented in real life. But if you take that Eastern Western and then put it on a substrate of an underpinning of neuroscience, that is the new learning. And that's the way we've got to go. And that's the one that we need a new word for. So, Zach, let's see if we can brainstorm that one. But that's, it, we need to move beyond this old-fashioned constructivism, which is always touted as the latest, greatest thing, but actually is not.
Yeah, it's weird, and we get in the realm of definitions and names and labels, and I've just basically decided to stick to a set of them. Like I will say, like, okay, so explicit teaching, systematic instruction. I'll make sure that people are very clear that I like high standards, expectations for behavior, and so on. So like my worldview, I try to make as coherent as possible to people, but you still get the idea that, well, you're not for students playing in the early years, or you're not you want to turn the clock back and basically just talk, right? And like, and just be lecturing. And I'm just like, there's a third way, and the third way is based on the evidence that we have around retrieval practice, and around interleaving, and around how we use worked examples, and how we scaffold. And a highly interactive form of instruction that involves the learner actively at every point, but it emphasizes the importance of memory. I mean, what are some of the things that we have learned when it comes to the neuroscientific perspective or the cognitive perspective around how kids learn?
Obviously, you and I are very much aligned on retrieval practice is really important. But I think where neuroscience helps bring us into a new perspective that does acknowledge at least a little modicum of rightness to constructivist approaches. And here's what I mean. The brain has something like 100 trillion synaptic connections. So it's kind of like if you had 100 trillion Legos and you can lay them out and connect them whatever way you want, in some sense, that is our brain on learning. And when we sit there and we can lay those Legos out in all these different directions and connect them in all these different ways, even when we're focusing on one particular problem, like how to say a phrase in Brazilian Portuguese that we haven't said before, or how to take a derivative in mathematics, or how to do a particular dance move. All of these things involve, they can still involve millions of synaptic connections, new ones that are kind of wrapping and beginning to work together. So when someone is beginning to learn something new, what you really want is you want them to figure things out for themselves, but at the same time, they've got like millions of connections that they could go in, and most of them are wrong. So how do you help nudge them towards the right connections without totally giving them the answer? And why would you even, I mean, why is it important not to give them the answer? Because if they figure something out for themselves, then what happens is you get this like little dopamine hit of, whoo, I figured that out, especially if you're curious about it. So a good teacher will get students curious which elicits this dopamine that like floats around. And then that good teacher will ask a Socratic question, like, what does that three mean there? Or something like that, you know? So you focus your attention more tightly on some specific area. What this is doing is it's narrowing that high dimensional neural space to a much smaller space where the student can, they're just looking here. And then they can much more easily see, oh, you mean I'm supposed to connect this idea with this idea? I got it. I figured it out. And the student has this, whoa, this feeling of delight, especially since you got them curious. They think they figured it out, but it was actually you, as a really good teacher, who just asked the right question to narrow that field to guide them towards the solution so that they themselves truly could construct their own learning. Now, this is not easy to do, and it often involves having very well-prepared materials, really good visuals, so students kind of see what's going on as you're asking your leading questions. And in many, unfortunately, modern approaches, as with New Zealand, do you know that teachers are supposed to like figure it all out, come up with all their curricular materials? Can you imagine that? I mean, it takes years to write a good textbook, and yet teachers are all supposed to come up with all their own curricular material. And, you know, because say students construct their own learning, and so do teachers. So I think where neuroscience is helping, one aspect that it's helping us with is it's not only saying we've got to have those engrams, those memories within us, but if we can create memories or engrams in part where the student truly has constructed it themselves, then they get more practice exploring that neural space, which is part of creativity, and they get a stronger connection because they make that connection themselves, and it helps make them feel like they're empowered, that they were able to do it. And all of these kinds of things, I think, are arising because we're really beginning to understand what actually happens in the brain when we are learning. Not just, you know, that retrieval practice is really good, that's true, but why is it good and how can we make it sometimes even better?
Excellent. You know, what makes me think about, and sorry if this for the listeners, if this is inside baseball, whatever, let's just talk about it. I understand that I can present an example that it's simply one change, one difference from the previous example and ask a question about it and basically create like an extrapolation opportunity. Or I can give two different examples and there's just the difference between them is so similar that they can do like interpolation, where they can see that these two things relate through a process of questioning. The thing that I think that I get stuck on, and I believe in this, is when the student just simply needs to memorize something that for which they don't have the prior knowledge, for which there's no real question, basically what we'd call a stipulation event, where I say, this is a five. What is this? It's a five, right? And the art that you mentioned of like getting them to generalize on the basis of examples, it makes sense to the extent that that's possible, which I think is great. But then what about the moment where you're like, you know what? This is what it is. You know, what are your thoughts on that framing that I just gave you?
I think that's a great framing and a great setup for us to understand why learning new languages can be of such great value in generalized improvement of our ability to learn. And what I mean by that is when you're learning a new language, you got to memorize a bunch of words. You just do. You need Utka is duck in Russian. That's just the way it is, and you just memorize it. And you don't have to explore, although you can use visuals to help you remember things. So there comes a time, and I don't think that we can possibly create a hard and fast rule that says this is when you memorize and this is when you don't. We simply know that a lot of times you just need to memorize some facts, and it's only after you have a number of these facts memorized that you can begin to play around with them and to learn how to put the sentences together in the foreign language, which is not something that you're necessarily memorizing. So I think learning in general involves both rote learning. You just got to know a bunch of, very simplistic facts. And like Natalie Wexler has pointed out, when they didn't teach the simple fact of the dates of the American Civil War and the civil rights movements, they're a century apart, but we don't need to memorize those stinking dates. And so, as a consequence, people started thinking, well, civil war, civil rights sounds the same. Abraham Lincoln must have been friends with Martin Luther King. And, so what I'm really saying is, seemingly simple facts are really important. How those facts might grow into something that is more complex will depend very much on the subject matter that you're studying. It's going to be different for learning a language, for example, as opposed to learning quantum theory and so forth. But there's going to be facts sometimes, and then sometimes there's going to be times when we will want to be able to start bridging students so that they can think more creatively with those facts and their prior knowledge. And the reality is, virtually everything we know and learn is always building on prior knowledge. So you're pointing out really good differences between maybe ways of quantifying knowledge, but we aren't there yet as far as like Bloom's taxonomy. I'm always very wary of. Because it's not anything that really grows from neuroscience. And what it does is discount the vital importance of simple facts and that you can't build higher level comprehension without those foundational facts. So I think you're bringing up a good point that we can't really resolve, but it's a good point.
I love to reduce these arguments way far, be totally reductionist, but it's almost like there's a camp that says if you learn a critical mass of these facts, you're going to be enabled to do really cool stuff with it. You can have discussions, you can write that essay, you can make that PowerPoint presentation because you're drawing from all of these things. You're not so encumbered by looking it up, asking someone else, or honestly just using prior knowledge that might not be correct or might not be sufficient to solve the problem, right? But then there's this sort of the other camp is that I get that, but I kind of want to jump a few stages ahead and just get them to do the applications. And while they do that, they might be discovering the knowledge on their own, or they might be developing some kind of like general purpose creativity skill or something that I can't really quantify, but I feel like that's important to me. Am I framing that right? Does that make sense?
I think so. What that just brings to mind for me is they had this problem with the Wrangler system in England around the, turn of the century, in the last century. And what was happening were all the top mathematics students in England were basically spending their formative years cramming for a test to see whether they were the best mathematician in England. And what this is thought to have done is that it kind of destroyed the creativity of a whole, generation of mathematics students. At least this is the thinking in some quarters. And so I think we just need to be mindful of, for example, what is going on in Eastern environments, educational environments such as Singapore, China, Taiwan. There's very good foundational importance placed on learning facts and being able to really understand the basics, not 10,000 ways to do creatively whatever the problems are, but really to understand at a fundamental level the most important things. But I think what happens in middle school and high school, that's where the competition can start going in. And then you lose that time that you need to be able to play and to be creative with the kinds of things you're learning. And this increasingly happens in Eastern societies, just because there's a lot of people and it's really pretty competitive. So I think we do need to have foundational knowledge and we do need to have time to play with it. And depending on the society, those ideas may be kind of butting heads one against the other.
And what's at stake if we don't get this right? Like if we continue down the path, kind of going back to that math article of sort of weak instruction, a lot of scattergun type of approaches to math, a lot of dozens of representations for a single method, a lot of time spent waiting on the concept to be developed through concrete materials and not relating them to abstract numbers and getting them into math, all the things you mentioned that we've talked about previously, like with Anastaki on this podcast. What's at stake then for the United States if we don't get this right?
It becomes a national security issue for our country. If you're not able to even develop your own citizens so that they can handle fundamental and foundational analytical skills, and you need to import from other countries to get people who have those skills, that really tells you there's a big problem. And in this world where analytical skills are becoming increasingly important, it's if it comes to a fraught relationship or lack of relationship or antagonistic relationship with other countries, and you can't even get an educated population, to back up what you need to do to keep your country safe and secure. That's a huge security issue. It's an issue in so many different ways because why should we be having kids grow up thinking they're incompetent and unable to do math when it's the way they're being taught. It has nothing to do with their competence or lack of competence. I just did a massive open online course with mathematician John Mitton. And John, like me, really struggled when he was young as far as his ability to do math. And now he's a professional mathematician. We sort of accidentally backed into finding out that it's possible to learn math. And we shouldn't have to accidentally have a few people who back into this. And there are a lot of countries that are teaching in a much more efficient way and producing a population that is much more capable of handling the analytical skills needed. I mean, It's even tough to find electricians to, and plumbers that can do the rudimentary calculations needed for these, basic disciplines. This is an indictment on the American education system.
Especially now as a new parent, and you kind of see the other side of this, and you can't really say anything to your child's school, but they bring back these assignments, and you look at them and you go, well, my child can access this because I'm doing these extra things on the side, and we're memorizing certain things because I know that's important. So I see her, and as she struggles through this kind of problem they haven't taught the parts that are inside the problem. these very lengthy, wordy problems, by the way, for kids who are just learning to read. As she struggles through them, but she lands on the answer. I can't stop myself from thinking about everybody else in the classroom who may not have these advantages, may not have spent as much time in at home tutoring and preschool and all these rich activities we do, after school. We need to start looking into this as parents. We need to start kind of maybe talking about it a little bit more. Maybe there's a cultural element. You kind of bring it up where when I talk to these parents in this nice neighborhood I live in, it's just sort of like, ah, they'll be fine. They'll be fine. It doesn't really matter. I don't know.
It matters a lot. So for me, for example, I knew that, having originally studied as a translator, I know how to learn a language. I know how learning math is in many ways like learning another language. So I was determined that our two daughters would be capable in math. So I put them both in Kumon Mathematics, which is a Japanese-based program developed by a Japanese mathematician, and it just takes you through and allows you to begin acquiring a feel for the relationships between numbers. But if you ask a school of education, and trust me, I have. They will tell you that is like the worst kind of thing you could possibly do for your child because it's a bunch of rote learning. So here's what happened when I put my two daughters through 10 years of a bunch of rote learning. Our older daughter was terrible at math. She's a good sport. She'd come to me, Mommy, may I do my Kumon mathematics today? It's like the perfect child. But she eventually did her medical residency at Stanford. She would have been one of those kids that, I just can't do math if she hadn't gotten this extra stuff. But our other daughter, she hated math. She saw herself, and I'm sure this was egged on by what she experienced in school, but she saw herself as an artist, the creative one. She hated math. So every day for a decade, that 20 minutes of extra practice of math, it was a battle to try and get her to do it. So then she graduates from high school, she goes off, she gets a studio art degree. And she goes out in the working world, and it is really, really hard to make it as an artist. So she went back to the university and got her master's in statistics. And I ran into the son of her graduate advisor when I was in Vietnam. And he said, I just don't understand it because my father usually never takes on students who have gone through the American educational system because they simply don't have a feel for the math. What was different about your daughter? And I was like, 10 freaking years of Kumon mathematics. And the thing is, it gave her that pattern, that easy recognition and comfort with math. I went and taught about 10 years ago at a very elite private school, and I went and talked to their math department, and they basically didn't even want to hear from me. And one of their teachers, kind of took me to the side and said, what's this Kumon program? I know I can't really even say the word around my department because they just hate it so much. So anyway, about 5 years later, they invited me back to the school. And I still remember I walked into the math group, and I'm thinking, oh boy, here we go again. And they were like, we love you. We love your technique, and they'd had the time to really work with it, and they became total converts. So it is possible for schools to change, to learn, but it's very regretful that we are losing generations of students because, parents are trusting, and it's actually mostly it's not the teacher's fault. It's how they've been trained, and they believe that they're being trained appropriately. But I think the cat's starting to get out of the bag, so to speak, that people are beginning to realize that there are really major problems in education, not only in this country, but in many areas around the world. And part of it is this paradigm cartel where schools of education think they circle the wagon, they're the only ones that know how children learn. And of course, it's important to have to talk to many different disciplines, except for them in education, because they're the only ones who know how children learn. And it's a major problem. And I think people are best off to explore some of the different educational options than the standard issue public education system in many cases.
It's unfortunate, and it ends up being the same people that can. That are probably already advantaged in a sense, right? They end up go pursuing those because they cost money and they require you to have some time. For me, it means, I do it. I tutor my daughter myself, but it's because it's because I have these materials that I get sent to me all the time. I have the expertise on how to use them, and I know how to get through them in a really nice way. A lot of parents don't have those skills, and so they're just sort of. I just feel for him. And this neighborhood's starting to learn a little bit more about it every day because of what we're talking about. Shifting really quickly to our final kind of bucket of questions. I don't want to turn this into another let's talk about AI discussion. I feel like it's just too much of that. But you do know a lot about sort of some of the trends that have been around online learning and instructional design for online learning, and now the current thing that we keep talking about is AI tutoring, and it relates a lot to how do we help our own kids if we're getting a standard diet of poor American education. It also relates to just your work with massive open online courses, and that for a while those were seen to be like those could be transformative. I think many people would say like. They didn't necessarily take off in a widespread way like the originators kind of thought, like hoped they would. What's the kind of state of things in your view for how we approach informal and formal education through like AI tutors and online learning?
I think for self-motivated learners, and I would call maybe 10 to 20% of students are really self-motivated. It is a wonderful world. I remember when I was trying to switch and learn in engineering when I was 26 years old, and and learn in math and science, and I'd never done anything like that before. And I would a good way to approach this, and I knew that from my language learning, was just to do lots and lots and lots of problems. But the challenge was, especially when you would get to, the university level engineering classes, professors keep their problems to themselves. It's like, I made this test up, and you're not going to get an old test of mine because it took me too much time. And I'm not even going to hand out homework solutions to you because other people could use them in the future. So You couldn't like just do a bunch of problems, check what was going on, learn the structure of what was going on, because people were so, tight and miserly with sample problems. But now you can go to AI, you can get, you can work as many sample problems as you want. You can load in stuff and ask for similar but somewhat different, or can this overlap with that, and so forth. It's a wonderful world. But by the same token, if you are not a self-motivated learner, like maybe 80%, then it's so easy to not learn, to just ask for the answers. And frankly, you can't be interested in everything. Teachers are always kind of like, you should want to have this knowledge because you're so intrinsically curious about this. And then they'll give you the most boring lecture that is bound to kill any curiosity that could have arisen. But really, you just can't be curious about everything. You pick your battles, and some of those are, you become curious because your teacher got you enticed into it. And the great thing is that you can use AI now to help you get more motivated. You can ask it, say, gosh, I'm trying to work on this paper and I just can't get my mind wrap around it, and I'm kind of bored with it. How can I get more interested? And it will tell you. It will give you wonderful metaphors. Metaphors are a terrific way to build from prior knowledge to something new that you're trying to learn. So you can ask for a metaphor on, main guard and scope in Python programming or something like that. So AI is, it's the best of all worlds and it's the worst of all worlds. And for kids, it's a little bit like handing them a stick of dynamite. It could be really powerful, but you may not want that kind of power. And I think we just aren't aware yet of the new generation that's going to come up without having had teachers that are trained to be aware that they need to be firm in ensuring that students actually get stuff in their noggin and not just, looking it up and being able to use AI, and that we're going to see increasing disparities between well-to-do families that have their kids, are educated in ways that, for darn sure make sure they learn, as opposed to those who don't. And often immigrant families are really at an advantage because even if they're really poor, oftentimes they can come from countries where rote learning is still respected. And so, I would go into the Kumon centers and I'd see, all these families from India or from China or Korea or wherever. They knew it was really important. And and so we're just going to see this odd disparity, I think, that is ever increasing of well-to-do people and the offspring of immigrants who are really doing well from an educational perspective versus your standard issue American kid who doesn't have these kinds of advantages.
It makes me think of my students who you'd start memorizing some stuff and they go, oh yeah, this is just like Quran practice, right? They like tell you, you're like, oh yeah, that's the same thing, right? We're just getting this in there and then we're going to do some stuff with it, right? I wanted to kind of leave you with a final kind of closing opportunity. I mean, looking ahead, what excites you most about teaching and learning in the next decade? What are you seeing as like opportunities for teachers and parents and learning scientists and so on when it comes to improving education.
It's so exciting, just bringing in insights from neuroscience. And there is so much there that we're just beginning to uncover, and it's really going to make learning easier, learning, more effective, less wasted time, help students become more excited about what they're learning. The future, what is it they say? The future is here. It's just unequally distributed. We see bits and pieces of all these fascinating insights that neuroscience is bringing in and going to be bringing into education. But I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg right now. There's so much more to come that we're not even aware of.
Barbara, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was a delight. It was really fun. We covered a whole range of topics. I'll put your information into the show notes of this podcast, and listeners, go check out some of those links and books and topics, especially the article that came out in the Seattle Times that we sort of circled around. Over here, we do, I feel like, have a bit of a crisis when it comes to math instruction, and so we're working to improve that. If you could please give this podcast a 5-star rating, spread it around, pass it to a principal or to a leader. They need to hear some of these conversations. And feel free to connect with me on my contact page on educationrickshaw.com. Thank you so much, Barbara. Take care.
Thank you. You're awesome.